Hello, and welcome to The Big Web Show, Everything Web That Matters. I'm your host, Jeffrey Zeldman, and my guest today is the wonderful Aaron Walter.
Aaron, hello, sir.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm feeling good.
Aaron is a VP of Design Education at InVision, which he just began doing. And prior to that, he founded the UX practice at MailChimp. Think about what that could mean. He founded the UX practice. He's the author of Designing for Emotion, Building Findable Websites. He's contributed to the UX Reader, Smashing Book 3, Redesign the Web, Interact with Web Standards, written for a whole bunch of websites, spoken all over. Very notable guy. Hey, hello. Hello.
Hey, hey. So such a pleasure to be talking to you.
It is. You know, one of the things I mentioned was that you wrote Designing for Emotion, one of my favorite books that we published in A Book Apart. And it's an evergreen. It just continues. Like, there are some books that are very much of the moment, right?
Yeah.
Like when a new idea is introduced. Like responsive web design or mobile first. It's like, whoa, that's so new. I've got to think about that. And then there are other books that just are like slow builds, like slow and steady builds, and they just never let up. And that's what Designing for Emotion has been. It's like nearly 500,000 copies have been sold, which is ludicrous.
Really?
Ludicrous for
wow.
Yeah, like – you're writing about web design and UX and branding. There shouldn't be that many people who even read that, about that in the world. I didn't think there were that many professionals in the world. I guess there are. But yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's cool to hear. I guess I don't pay attention to the numbers, but that's really fantastic to hear.
I don't pay attention either. In fact, I surprised myself when I learned this. I just learned the other day. I was asking our accountant a question, and I went to look at the figures, and I was like, does this mean what I think it means? Like, that can't be right. But that's what it meant.
That's cool, man.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I guess, you know, for me, writing that book was about kind of capturing a moment for me, or, you know, lessons that were being learned in our experiments at MailChimp. But to me, it was also trying to put those lessons into a broader context of design history. I mean, that book starts out not talking about the web at all. It talks about the arts and crafts movement and the thinking that was going on there, this battle between the man and the machine, which I see as a recurring theme in history. And I feel like that battle rages on today as we develop our medium.
Absolutely.
You know, we kind of go back and forth between design and development, and these two things have to work together.
And curation as an algorithm and curation as higher editors.
Absolutely. Right. I mean, that can, yeah, it can, you know, it's manufacturing versus, you know, something that's bespoke and handmade. It just permeates all of the modern life.
Jen Simmons.
I do. Yeah.
We were just talking about that the other day because, I mean, think about this. Netflix made a TV show called House of Cards. It's a great show, written by humans.
Yep.
Acted by humans, directed by humans, all, you know. But they started by doing an algorithmic analysis. They analyzed the data that they had.
Yeah.
And he said, well, people really like Kevin Spacey, and they like him when he has a sex scene, but not – here's how explicit they seem to like the Kevin Spacey. And they like him as a villain, but they also – it's like they –
yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So that shouldn't work.
Political thriller, yeah. They figure all that out.
To someone with a liberal arts education, that shouldn't work, right? Like I go, yeah, no, it should. This should all be coming from the artist and from their experience, right? You know, HBO does it the old-fashioned way. They get Martin Scorsese and say, "What kind of show do you want to produce? Right? What's on your mind, Marty?" But and yet, it's really good.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, what's interesting about the Netflix example is it's not just paint by numbers where they collect the data about what is getting the most viewership. And then they just, you know, build something to fit that hole. They use it as a compass, you know, of like we're headed roughly in this direction. And then there's a whole lot of artistry that happens in that direction. So I feel like that's such a nice balance of man and machine working together to make something that's incredible.
Right, right. It's like you're a designer. You know how something feels. You have intuition. You have experience. So rely on those things. But you also, you can't have every human experience. So look at the data and talk to people who use what you make.
Mm, yeah.
It's a big balance.
Yeah.
Now, you founded the UX practice at MailChimp. What does that mean? What was your, when they hired you, I mean, did they hire you or did you co-found the company? I mean, how did that work?
No, I did not co-found it. The MailChimp is, it's Ben Chestnut and Dan Curzius who are the masterminds and have put in, you know, thousands of hours and late nights and, you know, their heart and soul into making what I think is one of the great companies of today. It's a loved
company.
It is a beloved company, a beloved brand. It's a special place. And, you know, when I was hired, I was the fourth hire, you know, the first designer. And UX wasn't, you know, it was starting to become a thing in our industry, but we were still trying to figure out a lot. You know, we were thinking about information architecture and how all the how do we categorize the pieces and link them together? And user experience, we were starting to think more about, you know, cross devices, just a tiny bit. We were starting to think about, you know, different browsers and viewports and all kinds of things. But you know, as the first designer, I was doing front-end development and UI design and research, and all that felt like user experience, all, you know, mm-hmm. contributing factors to making a good experience for the brand, you know, for the customer. Wearing those many hats, it kind of forced me to think about how would I grow this design team to be able to do, you know, to make a really successful product, help it grow. And so I just hired based on those three categories of front end development, UI design, and research. And I intentionally kept those as a tight team.
You'd been a teacher before that. Did you hire any students?
You know, I did hire some former students, and some former students are still there doing great work at MailChimp. I didn't hire people that were still in college.
No. Right.
But I did have a few stellar students. I actually just hired someone who was one of my first students, and I coaxed him to leave his job at Apple and come do design at MailChimp. So, yeah.
And then you abandoned him.
I set him up for success, and I made space for him to succeed. So, yeah,
you said my work here is done.
Yeah, sort of. And you know, I think that's an interesting topic that I feel like I'm hearing from some other designers in our space that you know, just a little bit of reflection of what's meaningful and what do I want to be doing right now. Which can be a hard conversation to have with oneself, to kind of explore new territory. It's both fun and it's scary because new territory could be success and it could be failure, could be the unknown. That's a scary thing. But
you started teaching, hadn't you been doing something? I mean, wasn't that in itself a change? Hadn't you done work of a different kind before then?
I had, yeah. So I had these two kind of clear passages of my career where I spent something like, you know, 8 or 9 years teaching at colleges in the U.S. and a little bit in Europe too. And I was teaching interactive design stuff. So, you know, some of it was highfalutin, like, you know, classes like nonlinear narrative and history of communication media.
I love school.
Yeah, school's great. And then some things were very practical, like, you know, HTML, CSS, JavaScript, usability testing, UI design, all of those sorts of things kind of fit together.
Were you a self-taught designer?
I was. Well, so my background, you know, I spent my undergrad and graduate degree studying painting and drawing, which, you know, that's not graphic design. And I kind of learned that the hard way.
Yep.
My thought was, well, I'm a painter and painting is superior to design. So therefore I should be able to design. And then as I got out of college and I started doing design work, I realized, grids, typography, there's a lot of stuff that I just don't have in my quiver here. So,
you know who I think, Toulouse-Lautrec and Andy Warhol were two painters that I think also had the spirit of graphic designers. A lot of what Andy Warhol brought to, and before him, I really do see Toulouse-Lautrec as a forerunner in pop, because he of course he could do these really beautiful impressionist paintings, right, with the brush strokes, but he could also do these really vivid drawings with just a few strokes and really bold use of strong, simple color. And basically, that's graphic design, right? Communicating with a few bold visual gestures, communicating strongly.
Yeah, it's true. They straddled that line really well.
Do you still paint?
I don't. I don't paint. I love painting. I love looking at painting. Mm-hmm. I like thinking about it. But so I get this question a lot of like, you studied painting and drawing, and I hope that you still do that now. And when I tell people I don't, they feel this sense of like sadness and loss. No. Like I've traded in my soul for a paycheck or something, but it just doesn't feel like that to me, right? Because, you know, when I was young and naive, I felt like I could change the world with a painting. But, you know, like the web was coming up as I was studying painting, and it quickly became apparent to me that there was another medium of my time that was more powerful. And so much of what I learned as an artist, it was all around critical thinking and, you know, creative thinking. And that stuff translates so perfectly to what I have been doing for the past, you know, 16, 20 years, something like that.
How?
So much like, there are some people that are kind of list followers that, you know, like they know how to execute when they have clarity on direction. Mm-hmm. And then there are some people that can find their own direction and be comfortable with uncertainty and explore within a medium, you know, starting with something very abstract, starting with very loosely joined or maybe disparate pieces of information of a market, different types of audience, what's happening in the, you know, the broader landscape of the culture and technology. But there's, you know, there aren't too many people that can stitch those things together and turn that into something that's meaningful, you know, turn that into a product, turn that into a feeling of a brand. And that's something I was trying to capture in Designing for Emotion, or communicate that, you know, as much a note for myself too. But that's, I feel like that's what I've been doing for the past 8 years at MailChimp is, you know, looking at the big picture and translating that into something more concrete.
Totally. Totally. And I think designers and fine artists are similar in that they experience all this different stuff and they make notes of it. Maybe, you know, mm-hmm. in one case, sketches. Maybe for a designer, you're just sticking stuff in Evernote, you know, or putting something on Pinterest, on a pin board, or just, you know, sketching too. But eventually they synthesize some new thing out of all that stuff that they've experienced, or out of the relevant bits, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's the joy of what we do.
Yeah, I agree. That's my favorite part.
Yeah, I used to be a musician and I used to write fiction. And I don't feel like I'm a sellout or this is a drag or I wish I were still doing that stuff. I feel like, wow, I feel like I make a much more meaningful difference to the world as a web designer. This just not, I don't mean that this is true for everyone, just for me. For me, I, Jeffrey Zeldman, if I were a novelist, I don't think I'd be making as big a difference to me because of the level of talent that I have or don't have and so on. And music, same thing. There are some great musicians out there that have totally changed the world and they're wonderful. Yeah. But I don't think I was going to be one of them. But I think I can make a difference as a designer and I love that. It's satisfying.
It is. And so writing and playing music, these are forms of communication. And I think about your career path and what you've done over the past 20 years. I mean, incredible contributions to our industry and the medium and the way that we think about our work. You've built careers and mine included. I have a huge debt of gratitude for everything you've done for me over the years. But
you did that yourself, but thank you.
I certainly did hustle, but along the way I needed a little helping hand and you were always there. So I'm thankful for that. But what I want to say is your background as a writer and a musician has made you a troubadour for, this is the way we do things. This is, seeing the big picture and then communicating that in a way where we can all mobilize around that idea. And that is so powerful and valuable and it's rare.
I think designers who write have a real advantage. I mean, I keep saying that on this show, but you're another example. You're able to make a real difference, not only because you can design a cute chimp or have the idea for a cute chimp and hire the right illustrator to design that chimp or however that process worked, but because you're able to share concepts. I mean, look at all the writing. I'm on your website now, aaronwalter.com. And that's, if you're listening, that's Aaron with two A's and two R's.
It is.
Was that a birth certificate mistake that became, or was that a variant spelling because of heritage or something?
No, it's just my dad being nervous at the hospital and nervous or mentally fatigued, not present, and just spelled my name wrong. So, yeah.
Did you ever think about fixing it, so to speak? Not that there's anything wrong with it, but did you?
Yeah, just never felt broken to me. I like it. I like that it's weird. I like that it's a little bit weird.
Yeah, I mean, there's no reason Aaron couldn't. This couldn't be the normal spelling of Aaron. It's just. It's just a variation that's less often seen.
Yeah, that's true.
What did Aaron do in the Bible?
He was the mouthpiece for Moses. He was Moses' brother, and he's also the one that fell prey to temptation when Moses went up on the mountain to get the tablets. But yeah, he was a speaker.
Did he make the golden calf then?
I don't know if he made the golden calf, but he was certainly there worshiping it with the rest.
I always thought that was a strange story.
Yeah, it is.
Like, what kind of idiots? God parts the Red Sea for you, and then your boss goes up the hill, and you're like, yeah, maybe it's a golden calf. Eh, maybe it wasn't. Yeah. What's he done for us lately? I don't, it just... When you watch Bible movies, like not that either of us does much of that, I'm sure, but if you've ever seen like at a holiday time or something, you see it's at Easter that they play the one with Yul Brynner, and Charlton Heston as Moses, and it's hard to believe. They make the stories less believable because the characters act like comic book characters, not like
they do
like human beings with motivations.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. That's for sure.
Yeah, we're not gonna get into that. But Aaron, yeah. So my name Jeffrey means at peace with God, which
all right. Yeah. I like that.
And Zeldman means military Mercenary Soldier. 10.
Wow.
So man. Put those two together.
Peace with God, military soldier.
Yeah, like, you're like a mercenary soldier. A mercenary soldier who's at peace with God. It's a pretty. Yeah. It's like sounds like the Punisher.
Yeah,
does not does not sound good.
Yeah, do not cross Jeffrey Zeldman.
Yeah, and of course, I think anyone who knows me, I'm really very not like that at all. Very pushovery.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
pretty much. Pretty much. I never feel like the boss, even when I am the boss. You know, how did you, have you had like 50 people working for you?
No, most of the time I've had smaller teams. Okay. I think, you know, the biggest team that I was managing at MailChimp was, somewhere between 15 and 20 would be my guess. Something like
that. How do you manage that? I've never managed that many people. I would find that very challenging.
Oh, it is, and it was a lot of trial by error. But
you break them into smaller teams.
So there were smaller teams. That's one thing. I'll tell you the best thing that I learned. I spent a good number of years thinking that having team meetings were enough to keep track of the projects and keep track of the people, because those are the two critical parts: the people bits and the project bits.
Okay.
To make sure everything's on track. But I realized that one-on-one meetings were really critical. And seems like that might be something that a lot of young managers or, you know, people that kind of find themselves in a managerial position may overlook, is that, you know, making time on a regular basis every week or 2 weeks to meet with each person on your team individually, or each of your direct reports. You know, if there's kind of a tiered structure, if you're higher up, then you've got someone that reports to you and they've got people that report to them. Whoever your direct reports are, you do these one-on-one meetings where you don't talk about progress. You talk about their career. You talk about, you know, life, how things are going, concerns about the team or concerns about the company. And a lot of times, you know, it's just making space, and people will kind of bring up the things that are, you know, burdening them. And that's the way you keep people happy. You keep, you reduce attrition rates. You know, people don't leave. You help people grow, build into the career that they want to have. And you can head off, you know, issues that might create a missed deadline.
Managing for emotion.
Yeah. Managing people.
Managing people, but emotionally, one-on-one, being a mentor, being a friend, being a brother.
Yeah.
As much as, or sister, as much as, you know, and instead of come tell me about the status of the projects. You can do that separately.
Yeah, I think it's just like treating people like people.
Today's Big Web Show is brought to you by Bushel. For some people, IT is a task and not a career. But Bushel is a simple-to-use, cloud-based tool that anyone can leverage to manage Apple devices in the workplace. Bushel allows you to easily set up and protect all the devices that you distribute to your team or those that your team already has. Provide access to company email accounts, install work apps to devices individually or all at once, and separate and protect your team's personal data from company data. And if a device is ever lost or stolen, you can remotely lock it and wipe company data completely. Access all these features to easily manage your Apple devices whenever you want, wherever you are. Bushel makes the complex simple, so you can focus on what matters most and take back your nights and weekends. Your first three devices are free forever, and each additional device is just $2 per month with no contracts or commitments. Learn more at bushel.com/bigweb. That's bushel.com/bigweb. I worked for a few people that like we liked each other and hung out, but I don't think they were managing at the time. I think they were just like goofing off and hanging out. I can't recall a boss ever just finding out how I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
That's unusual.
Yeah.
I think that's unusual. But I think it's a good idea. I think it's a really good idea. Well, maybe, you know, I mean, MailChimp, where you left, they have a reputation for caring, and maybe that starts at the top. I mean, if people at the top actually care about their employees, then it's easier for the employees to actually care about the customers because they feel cared for. They're not just someone showing up, punching a clock. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Was that a company-wide practice?
It was, yeah. It's a company-wide thing that we started doing a couple of years ago. There were a few people doing it, and then it became, broader practice. But, we're all trying to figure it out because we grew from such a tiny little company to, a really big company over the past few years. But
I want to hear more about that. Oops, sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, yeah, and I'll be happy to share more about that. But I, just wanted to add that the idea of one-on-ones is not necessarily to create a rapport that is overly chummy, because I do think that when you're managing people, there needs to be some line in the sand that, if they're hanging out at your house or you're like going and getting drunk together, it makes it harder to deliver hard news.
Right.
So I've always felt like I need to maintain some kind of a line, but having that rapport where people can, they feel like this person is looking out for me, they care about me, they'll come to you with their problems, and you can work together to get it sorted out.
That sounds great. I want to hear more about that. I want to talk about Envision and education, but we have to take a little commercial break right here. And this is where I tell the wonderful listeners that this podcast is sponsored by A List Apart, alistapart.com, for people who make websites. A List Apart explores the design, development, and meaning of web content with a special focus on web standards and best practices. A List Apart started in 1997 as a mailing list and became a website in 1998. And I am the publisher of A List Apart and the founder. So I'm talking about something that I really know very well and something that I really love. I love the community that we've created, and I love the kind of information that A List Apart brings that it's hard to find at other places. Current articles at A List Apart include Design for Real Life, an excerpt from the new book by Sarah Watcher-Betcher and Eric Meyer. We say we're crafting personas to fit the needs of real people, yet we easily revert to abstractions when raw emotions enter the picture. Design for Real Life is a great book about treating human beings not as people, not as edge cases, and designing to include everyone. And also in A List Apart, currently Design for Real Life, an interview with Sarah Watcher-Betcher by Micah McFeeters, the managing editor of A List Apart. Web Animation, Past, Present, and Future by Rachel Neighbors. Aligning Content Work with Agile Processes by Brendan Murray. Impulses and Outcomes by Matt Griffin. Using Emotional Intelligence to Defeat Workplace Drama by Brandon Gregory. And two articles on Designing the Conversational User Interface by Matt Mariansky. That and lots more are waiting for you at alistapart.com. And it's free and it's awesome. So go read A List Apart, because you can't listen to podcasts all day. Alistapart.com. Thank you. Okay. That was a very strange.
That's a lot of good. That's a lot of good content.
Well, that was a commercial that wasn't actually written. So our sponsorship message, I guess on podcasts, we don't say we have commercials. That's old media. We have sponsorships. We have sponsorships.
That's right.
So how did you make the move to Envision, and what do you envision yourself doing there?
Sorry. Ooh, look what you did there.
I'm so sorry. Dad joke.
Yeah. So, I've been talking to Clark Valberg past month or so about Envision. I guess I should back up a little bit and just say, I've been using Envision for a number of years at MailChimp. And in fact, I Clark called me back in 2011. I was at MailChimp running UX, and he was asking how we do prototypes and, you know, how we work through ideas, kind of picking my brain, but also just curious, like, well, what if we had, you know, built something like this? Would this work? And so he was just kind of looking for feedback. So we've known each other since the very beginning. And Envision over the past couple years at MailChimp has become more and more influential in our work. So it's a product I know. It's a product that I really enjoyed as a designer, which is, you know, a big reason why I was so interested in Envision as a company and, you know, contributing in whatever way I could. But, you know, when I took a couple months off before I did anything, I, you know, took a break from MailChimp. I was just, I just wanted to hang out with my family, to be honest, take a little break and catch my breath. And, I felt like I had,
you've been going for 8 years at that point.
Yeah, that's a long time, you know, in our industry, that's a long time.
It is.
And I had also, made some key hires that would, ensure that I could exit and, you know, take a break and design would stay strong at MailChimp. I mean, there were already a lot of smart people there.
Right.
But, you know, from my end of things, what I was responsible for, I wanted to make sure, you know, the right folks were there. And I hired Todd Dominey, who is Todd. If you don't know Todd, folks, just go Google Todd Dominey Effect. You're going to land at A List Apart, a wonderful article about his influence. But he's someone that has influenced me over the years. I've always admired his work. And I just couldn't believe our fortune of being able to bring him onto the team. And I worked with him for a year or so on some product stuff. And he's awesome. So, and there were a number of other hires that helped make that possible. So, you know, I stepped away, took a break, went to Disney World with my family.
Did you go on that elevator, that for the Twilight Zone elevator?
No, I don't know anything about that.
You have two young boys, so probably not. Mostly gentle stuff, like It's a Small World After All.
Yeah, Winnie the Pooh, Peter Pan.
That's the best stuff.
Honestly, I think so too. I thought that was the coolest.
I have no desire to do that. The super scary stuff.
Yeah, we did Jedi training too. That was incredible.
That's fun. I don't know why people enjoy things that make you think you're dying.
Yeah.
It's going to happen sometime. I'm content to wait.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. I'm with you. I don't need to, you know, get freaked out on roller coasters, though I did go on a few.
When I was a kid, to prove that I wasn't a chicken, I would do things that I was terrified of. But of course, I really was a chicken. And in fact, I was being most cowardly by doing those things. Like, I was so scared of the social pressure.
Yeah.
That I would, like, cross a ravine walking on a pipe in Pittsburgh thinking.
Oh, man.
I think about it now and, you know, like, I could have died and then my parents would have had a dead child. And how horrible is that? And now I don't care who knows that I'm a complete coward. It's fine. I have no, you know. I'll just keep going on. It's a Small World.
Yeah, I'm with you. I don't need to cross any pipes in over a ravine right now.
How old are your boys?
2 and 5.
2 and 5. Okay.
Yeah.
That is such a great time for Disney World.
It is. It was cool. 2 might be a little bit young because there's a lot of confinement to the stroller, which leads to some angst. But
did he think Mickey Mouse was real though?
I think that they both sort of thought like, there's Mickey Mouse. This is weird and scary. I'm not sure why it's weird and scary. But in their mind, they're like, it's not a mouse. It's not an animal. It's not a person. What is that thing?
They didn't know it was an actor in a costume.
My 5-year-old probably grasped that. My 2-year-old, I don't think he totally got it, but, they just like that they, you know, they're huggy and they're soft and, you know, funny. So, yeah.
How does Main Street make you feel?
Main Street?
Yeah, Main Street USA. You know, that thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been reading a biography of Walt Disney and the philosophy behind Main Street, which is really interesting. Where he, I don't know if you know this, but he grew up in Missouri. His best time of his life, he thought, was this small town in northern Missouri.
Yeah.
And it was very idealized, this Main Street that was all, you know, perfect in his mind. And so Main Street in Disney World and Disneyland is designed after that. And for me, like, I'm walking down Main Street and my wife and I actually had a conversation. I was just like, man, this is so exciting. I want to go into these shops and these places and see what's inside. And she's kept saying, like, why are you interested in this? Because it's all just the same stuff in there. It's like the same stuff made in China. But the facades to me felt so curious and magical and enticing. And then I'd go inside and it's like 40 of the same stuffed animal and like snow globe. It just, you know, it didn't quite deliver the way that I had kind of hoped.
Is the book you're reading by any chance Neil Gobler's Walt Disney, The Triumph of the American Imagination?
No, it's not that one. I can't remember the...
Is it Pat Williams' book, How to Be Like Walt?
I think it's just called... I'm looking it up here real quick. It's just called Walt Disney.
But Bob Thomas? I've read two. I've read Walt Disney, The Triumph of the American Imagination by Neil Gobler, which is like a book for adults. And then I've read Who Was Walt Disney, a children's book by Whitney Stewart. You know those, if you don't know them, you soon will. Well, if you have a five-year-old, you probably do know these. Who was Shakespeare? Who was, you know these books?
They're
these 25, 30-page books. With big illustrations, big friendly illustrations.
Yeah.
Who was Gandhi? It's like mind blowing. Right. Like I thought I knew about Gandhi. Who was Gandhi? And it's 30 pages and you're like, oh my God. I mean, before he even gets to India, just what he did in South Africa. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Just like, and he was a guy who was educated and the Disney book's good too. They're not controversial, right? So they're for children. So it's pretty interesting.
Right.
And I mean, eventually they have J.K. Rowling. Who was J.K. Rowling?
Yeah.
The fault with that one is that they keep trying to explain away her genius by going, she had a mean teacher. Maybe that's where she got the idea for Mr. Snape. I'm like, yeah, no, I think she got the idea for Professor Snape because she's effing brilliant.
She's brilliant. Yeah. No kidding.
Not because she had a bad teacher that probably helped. She had a mean teacher that probably helped her write it, but. You know,
right. But she can tell a story.
She can tell a story. She fell. Yeah. She fell at an amusement park. That's probably how she got the idea for Quidditch. No, I don't think it is.
You know, right.
I think it's because she's brilliant. But
yeah.
But yeah, reading about Disney is great.
Yeah, it's it's the Gobler book actually is the one I'm reading.
Oh, you are reading that? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. It's fascinating. I mean, he's a fascinating individual.
He was not motivated by commercial success at all.
No. He just wanted to make the best work.
He wanted to make the best animated. He wanted them to breathe. He wanted the illusion of life. And
yes.
He threw away stuff that any other studio would have put on the screen.
Yes, totally.
If you're a designer or a UX person, there's so much inspiration to be gathered from reading his story. Do you know the story of the garbage cans at Disney World?
No, I know they're all specifically designed for their location.
They're designed for their location and they're designed, it was Disney's idea. So he loved growing up in Missouri, but he hated carnivals. He liked the excitement of carnivals, but he thought they were tacky, right? People were drinking alcohol and they were making out and it was coarse. And so when he wanted to make Disneyland, this first one, he didn't want, he felt that if people were walking down Main Street and they saw someone else's garbage just sitting there in the hot sun in a garbage can, that they would turn them off and it would give kind of a gaudy carnival atmosphere. So he went to the makers of garbage cans and said, we're going to need covered garbage cans that, you know, where you don't really see other people's garbage and you don't smell it.
Yeah.
And nobody would make it for him. All that he went to all the big companies, and they wouldn't make it for him. So So he found some like wire, a company that made stuff out of metal, and got them to do it, and they became very rich as a result. And and cities were so inspired that every city except New York, where I live, every other city in America has adopted the Walt Disney model, and puts garbage cans on the street that cover the smell and visual of garbage. Where for some reason in New York, we have an open wicker basket, open metal basket where you can see and smell other people's garbage, because it makes New York in the summer such fun.
Yeah, that's incredible. I didn't know that.
Do you know the story of the spacing, though?
Of the spacing?
The placement.
I know that he was very focused on sight lines, and that's something that I paid attention to the whole time when we were in Disney World. Like, the sight lines are just incredible.
Right, right. The design of the Main Street experience as you approach Cinderella's castle.
Yeah. Yep, that's incredible. Although I will say that Cinderella's castle is kind of like Main Street, where you see this magical vision in a distance, and then you get there, and like, where is the magic? There's
the plastic
payoff. Yeah, like, you can't go in and explore it. They've got a little thing on the side where you can get your photo taken with the princess, but I want to go in that castle and see like what's there.
Most of it's blocked off.
Yeah,
they do have meals there. You can have a character breakfast if you sign up for it in advance.
Interesting.
And then it's kind of annoying, though. Like, you can't really – you get two bites of food, and then Snow White comes to your table and talks to your kids. Yeah. And then,
right. Yeah.
But your kids are just about the age.
Yeah, we definitely did a lot of character things.
Today's Big Web Show is also brought to you by Meh.com. Meh. .com is a classic daily deal site created by the founders of the original daily deal site, Woot.com. Now Amazon acquired Woot, and Woot started selling all kinds of stuff all at once, and it just wasn't the same anymore. So these guys, who started Woot in the first place, quit Woot to start Meh. Meh.com is a daily deal site that goes back to selling just one thing a day. And of course, it's cheaper than anywhere else. Every day, they launch a new deal and put up a new story. There's videos and an active community that makes Meh a fun place to stop by and an easy routine to get into. Now, plenty of people come to Meh every day just to read the daily story and check out what's going on at the site, even if they don't have any interest in what's being sold that day. So, head on over to Meh.com, that's M-E-H.com, to check it out.
Hey, you know, one thing I was going to bring up with you about Walt Disney and the parallels of his time and our time. Mm-hmm. You know, we often think of our medium as mature, as, you know, we've kind of figured things out, and you know, clearly there's some stuff that we're still working on, but you know, it's only been, you know, 15, 20 years or so that we've been at this game, and there's still a lot of tools and processes that are half-baked. Or in flux. And, you know, that's something that stood out to me in reading about Walt Disney and the advent of animation, that, you know, when he started, people were drawing on, you know, sheets of paper where the character and the foreground, or, you know, foreground and background were merged. Mm. And then they started to figure out, you know, cell animation. But so much of what we know of as animation today and the way it matured was because of Walt Disney's innovation,
right?
His personal innovations and what happened at his studio. For example, you know, it used to be that animators would do entire cartoon shorts where they would draw the whole thing, and then they would ink it, and then they would photograph that, and then they would watch it. And you think about how long it would take to hand animate like a 10 minute short. And then, you know, that process, we're talking months to produce. So the feedback loop of being the artist doing the creative work and then seeing the output is months.
Right.
And that makes it really, really hard to learn and really get good at your craft. So they weren't figuring out story. They weren't, you know, figuring out character. They were just figuring out how to make things move and, you know, do funny things.
So he invented agile development in a sense.
Yeah.
by breaking it down and saying, okay, we have this room. Let's look at this sequence. Let's look at it with roughs. Let's animate these roughs and see if it's lifelike. Yeah.
And so they would do sketches. They wouldn't ink it. They would do quick sketches. They do walk cycles. You know, it was really important that personality be part of the work that they were doing, which, you know, brings us back to designing for emotion and putting personality into our work. Is like he saw that as the pinnacle, the zenith of great artistry was putting personality into their work. And so they would take these sketches and experiment with, you know, movement and flow and personality. And then they would put that in a closet they called the sweat box, which had a Leica camera, and they would do quick shots of those. And then they would watch them right there. So they would make the drawings in an hour, photograph it, watch it. And they cut that feedback loop by, you know, just exponentially so much faster than the competition. And people don't know this, but because we just think of Disney as like, you know, animation and storytelling is kind of was for so long, those things were synonymous. But they blew the competition out of the water. No one could compete. And they were total underdogs being on the West Coast because all animation was happening in New York. And it was like Felix the Cat and everyone kind of imitating that. And
but all that stuff was gag oriented. It wasn't story. It wasn't character.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. And he developed that whole idea of, you know, the character and the personality. So I there's so many parallels with what happened then and what Walt Disney figured out and what's happening now and how we're trying to figure out our tools. We're trying to get these faster feedback loops. We're trying to make it more real, more quickly so we can use it while we design it. It's a really special time, and reading this kind of puts into context how, fortunate we are as designers to be working right now.
I know. And I've got another parallel that this stuff brings up. When I was a kid, I thought Walt Disney drew all the pictures, wrote the story, drew the pictures, made the Mickey Mouse voice, did everything, right? And in fact, there were lots of films that he didn't draw a single frame of.
Yeah.
But he was still a guiding factor in it. And that is how our medium is maturing as well. When most of us started, we would do everything for our client. It'd be like, yeah, I'll write the copy, I'll write the code, I'll make the design, right? I'll go do the testing. I'll host it on my machine. I'll telnet it for you. Like, we did everything. And now it's much more fragmented it's much more collaborative. And yet at every stage, there's someone, might be a design director, a creative director, a UX director. There's somebody who's sort of synthesizing what the different people are doing and helping them have a shape to it. Also, you know, so we're like, when we started, it was like movies that lasted 3 minutes and didn't have a director or a screenplay. And now we're like stories with screenplays and directors.
Yeah. Yeah, as a medium matures, specialization emerges. You've got to have that specialization to be able to do higher level work.
Speaking of animation, it's becoming a really great part of interfaces that we design, right?
Little bits of
movement. Rachel, I mentioned earlier, and Val Head, people are writing really wonderful books about this and talking about this stuff, using some of the same principles. Val Head talks about, what was it, like the 12 principles of the Disney studios for animation, like squash and stretch, and what's the one where before something happens, it sort of has a reaction in the opposite direction, just right? Like before someone jumps forward, they sort of back up and tense themselves. Basically things that they observed in life, real things they observed in life.
Yeah.
And now we do this with buttons.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes it more visceral, and you know, it kind of relates to the physical world. So we have it just taps into our already inherent knowledge of how to interact with things.
I think because we're designing for screens that people touch too a lot, it makes us more tactile as designers. I think, you know, when someone's clicking a mouse, it makes more sense to give them a bunch of buttons that are static that they can click that have on-off states or highlights, but once people are touching an interface, you want them to have the illusion of tactile control. And so you end up making a button that seems to move slightly under their finger the way maybe the way an old Dieter Ram stereo component button would sort of, right, respond to your finger a little bit, like, touch me, touch me.
Yeah. Yeah. Have you seen the IBM Design Lab, their visual language they've been working on?
No.
Basically a style guide. And what I love about what they're doing is they're looking to the history of IBM hardware, how things spin, like tape, you know, like an old tape, data tape thing. Mm-hmm. They would use that feel of that animation for a loading animation, and you know, all kinds of other different knobs and dials and things that are part of IBM's history, and they're putting that into their style guide now. And you know, maybe you get that, maybe you don't, but I love that it's just sort of like the DNA is translated into the next thing.
You don't have to get it. I always think with stuff like that, it's like the fifth time you read a book, a certain book, or watch a certain movie, or look at a certain painting, and you're like, oh, that pattern's being replicated in three different places. How did I not know that? You didn't have to know it. You felt it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like later you can appreciate it mentally, but you know, initially it's just something feels right. Right. You know, look at all the designs that use like the golden mean and all that stuff. It's not that most people looking at them are analyzing them or pulling out a protractor. It's that it just feels right. There's just something about it that feels like the things in nature that we observe that are beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. It's magical how that happens.
Where is that IBM? I'm looking at IBM.com/design. But I'm not seeing the thing you're talking about, the style guide.
You know, I don't know off the top of my head. I know if I search my Twitter stream, I will find it. But I'll have to look that up and send a link to you so you can put it in the show notes.
Okay. So we've talked about the Domini effect. We've talked about Walt Disney. We've talked about MailChimp. Tell me more about what you're going to be built. You know, you talked about building a UX practice at MailChimp. Talk about building a design education initiative at Envision. What's that going to entail? What do you think? What do you know? What are you still guessing?
Yeah, so there's still a lot yet to be figured out here. But in a nut, what we see at Envision is, you know, to go back to this analogy of animation and Walt Disney figuring out the tools in that particular time. I know that I see this time and Envision being a critical thing, a critical tool set that we need at this point to be able to do design better. But, you know, we need to pair that tool set for our medium with our best practices, the best way to work together as a team. How does design work when it scales from, you know, just two or three people to 20, 200, 2,000 people. How do we stay, you know, collaborative and open? So I'm going to be exploring a lot of this stuff, and a lot of it is pulling from, you know, years of experience doing this at MailChimp, where, you know, I certainly learned a lot doing it the right way and doing it the wrong way. But I'm also going to be pulling those best practices together from other people's experience as well. So how that's going to manifest, we have some ideas. One of the things I'm going to be doing is helping. We have a lot of customers, about 2 million customers. There are so many major companies that are using Envision to drive their design process. There's, you know, Netflix and, you know, MailChimp is one of those. Twitter. And so I will be going to some of these companies, talking about best practices, talking about how to put design at the heart of strategy. So part of it is being present, and part of it is, you know, writing, publishing. And, you know, I have some other things that I'm not really ready to talk about just yet, but other ideas of how this could come about. But we're really just trying to make, we're trying to push design forward, helping companies and organizations learn to do it the right way.
That's very cool. Do you see yourself putting on conferences, making videos?
videos are interesting to me. Not conferences, but videos are interesting to me, and not necessarily how-to videos, but more like these are stories from the front lines, and we can take these experiences and boil us down into a principle that we can, easily share with the rest of your colleagues.
Super cool. And I see you've sent me the style guide for the IBM style guide. It's at ibm.com/language/design/. There are too many slashes. It'll be in the show notes.
Yeah, it's a long.
That's also, it's educational. Do you see yourself making style guides at Envision?
I don't think so. We have a great product team that is super talented, and they're already doing that stuff. Great design team. So, it's an interesting position. It's a new space, this kind of greenfield space. So although I have some ideas of what we want to do with design and education, there's still a lot to be determined, which I'm excited about because it brings together these two seemingly disconnected parts of my career, which is education and design and
words and music.
Stitching us. Yeah, exactly. Just stitching it together in a way that I'm super excited about, not only for selfish reasons, but also just for, I feel like we can do this really well and help a lot of companies and help push design forward. And, it's stuff I believe in.
That is fantastic. How much travel will you be doing?
To be determined. I mean,
they're not in Athens, right? Or are they?
No, Envision's a totally distributed company, so there's no central headquarters. We're all over the world.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a pretty amazing company.
So, what kind of tools do you use to manage a team in a situation like that?
There's a lot of Slack, as you might imagine. There's a lot of Google Hangouts. And then, kind of the standard thing of just email and calendars and so forth. But there are definitely people do get together and work on things. A lot of the design team is in London or kind of in that area. So they get together occasionally, like at a hotel, like collaborative space, and we'll work through stuff.
Like at we here in New York, we have things something called Breather, and I think it's in other places too. It is in other places too.
Like they
basically take unused office spaces. So you're a landlord, and you have an office building, but you have no tenant in 6G. So Breather takes it over, and they rent it by the hour. And if you know what New York office rents are like, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
That you just, with a distributed company, that you just occasionally rent a room that has everything you need, table, couch, Wi-Fi, everything.
Yeah.
And the rest of the time, people work wherever they work.
That is great. Very cool.
Do you have an office you work out of, or are you doing this from home?
I have an office at my home that, I designed this office to spend a lot of time here and be comfortable and make it a creative space for me. And I'm only second day on the job here working from home. But when I was at MailChimp, I was working 2 days in Athens and then 3 days in Atlanta. And if you don't know the geography, that's about 60, 70 miles away or about an hour and 15-minute drive. So, yeah, it's a huge commute.
Were you driving every day?
I was driving those 3 days, yeah. And
that's
the commute
rough.
it was hard.
You did that for 8 years?
Well, when I was teaching in Atlanta, so I actually did that for about 16 years.
Good Lord.
Yeah, and I drove around the circumference of the Earth 6 times.
Wow.
That's how much I drove.
There's an infographic in my head.
282 days of my life I drove.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
So and, books on tape.
Yeah. And that was actually a big part of how I learned over the past few years. It's just lots of books and podcasts and articles, listening to your show. Yeah.
Now when you listen to it, you won't have to be driving.
Yes. Now when I listen to podcasts, I'm running, not driving.
That is an improvement.
Yeah, feels good.
We're about out of time, but I really want to thank you. You're one of my favorite people. And I think when you announced that you were moving to Envision, I mean, there's so much love for MailChimp. This is going to sound cheesy. There's a lot of love for MailChimp. There's a lot of love for Envision. Yeah. There's a lot of love for you. It's all like everybody's happy. Like these are all good things. Sometimes people make announcements and their friends are like, oh, I hope they made a lot of money because their life's about to suck. But here it's just like, oh, that's all so good. So we'll be in touch. We'll look forward to seeing more.
Great.
And thank you.
No, thank you. This is fun. I mean, it's always fun to chat with you, Jeffrey. And to do it on your podcast is an honor. So thanks for having me.
Pleasure. Thank you.